most important indigenous movements in the Americas. The rebel army, known by its Spanish acronym as the EZLN, went public on New Year's Day of 1994 and has built up an autonomous system of traditional indigenous governance in its civilian-based communities ever since. But the civilian Zapatista communities have experienced a series of attacks over the years, including one in the Lacandon jungle town of La Realidad, which killed a well-respected leader and teacher known by his alias Galeano. Shortly after the murder, nearly 4,000 people traveled to La Realidad to pay their respects. During the event, the EZLN's iconic spokesperson, Subcomandante Marcos, made his first public appearance in 5 years, only to announce his final act. Tim Russo brings us this report from La Realidad, Chiapas.
Compañeros y compañeras, hermanos y hermanas.
Thousands of masked Mayan Zapatistas and hundreds of Mexican and international supporters gathered in the village of La Realidad on May 24th to condemn the brutal murder of José Luis Solís López, known by his nom de guerre as Galeano. The Zapatistas say the homicide was part of a premeditated paramilitary attack by members of the COAC-H, an organization of small farmers with ties to Mexico's ruling party. The May 2nd attack was the latest in a series of similar acts of violence by the COAC-H since late January. Zapatista spokesperson Subcomandante Insurgente Moises described it as part of an ongoing government strategy to pit indigenous farmers who accept government aid against Zapatista civilian communities.
Los malos gobiernos piensan y quieren que nos matemos entre indígenas.
The bad governments want us indigenous people to kill each other. They want us to lose our heads, to be crazier and more murderous than they are, so that they can tell the media they bought us off, and that it's a community-level problem.
The Fray Bartolomé Human Rights Center found that 15 unarmed Zapatista civilians were wounded in the May 2nd attack, which also led to the destruction of the local Zapatista clinic, school, and 3 vehicles. While the EZLN never disarmed, it has opted to avoid armed conflict over the last 20 years. Its civilian base has built up an autonomous governance system, including significant health and education infrastructure without state or federal funding. The Zapatistas launched an initiative last year called the Escuelita, or Little School, to share the lessons of building autonomous institutions with national and international supporters. Galeano, the murdered teacher, played an important role in the Escuelita effort. Freddy Ramalho, a youth coordinator with the Brazilian Landless Movement, who has been visiting EZLN communities as a part of a 3-month exchange program, said that the Zapatista struggle for land and autonomy is similar to and an example for other organizations involved in social struggles against capitalism and imperialism. After midnight, between intermittent tropical downpours and hours after the thousands present in La Realidad had visited the grave of Galeano, the enigmatic Subcomandante Marcos came on the stage to speak publicly for the first time since 2009.
Quisiera pedirle a las compañeras, compañeros y compañeroas de la Sexta.
Marcos, who has been the figurehead and media magnate of the Zapatista movement since its January 1, 1994 surprise appearance, had come to announce he would no longer be the voice of the EZLN. He said that the time had come to be replaced, not because of internal struggles, personal sickness, or death, as rumors have suggested over the last years, but rather because he had gone from being a spokesman to a distraction. Marcos added that his persona was a bridge character the EZLN had created to interact with a media and public that has persistently ignored the indigenous commanders and traditional community leaders.
The time is 6:03. Coming up next, Rose City Native Radio, here on KBOO, Portland.
Too much of nothing. Make a man abuse a king. He can walk the streets and boast like most, but he won't know.
This is Ed Melnick, host of the singer-songwriter edition of the Monday Sampler, on the first Monday of every month between 2 and 4 p.m. I'd like to invite you to join me on December 1st for a very special Monday Sampler. In the second hour of the show, we'll be featuring Bob Dylan and the band, The Complete Basement Tapes. In this one-hour special, you'll hear many of the songs from the Basement Tapes, as well as insights from Dylan's biographer Clinton Halen, producer Steve Berkowitz, and many others. Rita Houston narrates Tying the Whole Thing Together. That's Monday, December 1st at 3 p.m. right here on the Monday Sampler.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Shadows of Liberty Screening and Media Reform Action Tour, Friday, December 12th at 7 p.m. at the Oregon Labor Center in Portland. The documentary film Shadows of Liberty reveal insider accounts of a broken media system with renowned journalists, activists, and academics, including Amy Goodman, Danny Glover, Julian Assange, Norman Solomon, Chris Hedges, and more. This film champions the idea of an independent media where truth and integrity are the norm, not the exception. Again, that's the Shadows of Liberty Screening and Media Reform Action Tour, Friday, December 12th, 7 p.m. at the Oregon Labor Center, 3645 Southeast 32nd Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from U.S. Agencies Credit Union, providing local banking resources since 1936 and proudly serving Native Americans and their families. Details at usacu.org. You're listening to Rose City Native Radio. I'm your host, Jackie Malmstrom. How's it going, Indian Country? Happy Thanksgiving, happy Turkey Genocide Day, happy Genocide Cover-Up Day, happy National Day of Mourning, whatever you like to call it. Hello, I am here with you now. So, the show's going to start off a little heavy. This is a very serious holiday for us Natives here. But I'd also like to comment on the events happening in Ferguson. In light of that, I am reminded of our fallen brother, John T. Williams, who was shot and killed by Seattle police a few years ago. And it's very reminiscent of that. His brother is still in Seattle, still seeking justice for his brother's murder. And so with that being said, I'm going to start off the show with a song that A Tribe Called Red had made for him. It is called Woodcarver, here on Rose City Native Radio.
Put the knife down. The family of a wood carver shot to death by a Seattle police officer says that an autopsy shows he was not facing the officer. Officer Ian Burke shot and killed John T. Williams in August. Williams' family tells our newspaper partner, the Seattle Times, he suffered 4 gunshot wounds on the right side of his body. The Seattle Police Department's Firearms Review Board completed a confidential inquiry Monday to determine if that shooting was justified, and that review has now been passed on to the police.
We're waiting to hear more about what led to a deadly shooting in the city part of downtown Seattle tonight. We know a man was shot and killed near the intersection of Bourne Avenue and Howard Street. John Hopperstead picks it up from there.
Seattle police are investigating whether the shooting of wood carver John T. Williams was justified. But in the minds of those who led a memorial tonight at the place he died, it's clear what happened.
The Seattle police officer who shot and killed Native American wood carver John T. Williams in August has turned in his gun and badge. Police sources tell 313 Fox News the department's firearms review board reached a preliminary finding that Officer Ian Burke was not justified in opening fire that day. Amy Allen has more.
A woman crossing the street is visibly shaken by the shots. After the woman walks out of frame, we hear a female voice say something to the officer. It's garbled. It sounds like she's asking, "What did you do that for?" Officer Burke responds,
"Man, he had a knife and he wouldn't drop it."
Kind of didn't seem right, you know. I understand that he got shot 4 times, and it just, to me, it seemed a little excessive.
One witness we spoke with said he never saw a knife, and that the victim was not acting in a threatening way.
He was murdered for no reason. This man was disabled. He was deaf in one ear, and he never harmed his soul.
But Williams' supporters say the video proves what they believe, that it was an unprovoked shooting of a harmless wood carver.
I think that this was a murder.
Heaven just is done for John T. Williams.
He had problems, but you know what? There is no reason to take a gun and kill that man that way.
Later, fellow officers talked to Burke out of the camera's view. On the tape, Burke never tells fellow officers he was afraid and never says Williams was threatening anyone.
Strong community reaction tonight from those who argued all along that John T. Williams should have never been killed.
If you spent 5 minutes with this man, you would have never gotten any information that he was violent or could hurt you in any way.
That was A Tribe Called Red, Woodcarver. Coming up next, speaking of A Tribe Called Red, they have come out with a new song just in time for Thanksgiving. It features a clip from one of my personal favorite movies, The Addams Family. This is A Tribe Called Red with Burn Your Village to the Ground.
Come without a win, and so I idle no more. Rap the plight of the poor, cause educated warriors are vital to war. And we battling oppression, got me stressing, wondering if I'll ever learn my lesson. Cause I can't let my people go, and I can't let my weakness show. Even when I'm hopeless and I'm pitiful, I keep going on that I'm aboriginal.
I got this aboriginal soul, I got this aboriginal flow, I got this pain that I can't shake, ties to my people I can't break. Got my tribe that shows me love. So when I rise, you rise, yeah. Come on, let's rise, get it.
It's been months since I seen a native. It's messing with my creative approach. It's got me jaded, isolated. No one understands me like my people. These white kids don't know my struggles. I ain't equal in their eyes. Their intolerance brings me troubles. I'm not the noble savage doing damage to the perception of who I am. Self-destruct when I self-construct my own plan of my identity from their affinity to rape the culture. They rape the land, shaming in the end just to save the man. But this in the end never dies. I got this aboriginal soul. I got this aboriginal flow. I got this pain that I can't shake. Ties to my people I can't break. Got this history in my blood. Got my tribe that shows me love. So when I rise, you rise, yeah. Come on, let's rise, yeah.
I got those reservation blues. Reservation blues. I got those reservation blues. Reservation blues. I got those reservation blues. Reservation blues. I got those reservation blues. I got those reservation blues.
Look at all around, look around at the whole thing. If your skin is brown, then you're down for the old pain. Look at all around, look around at the whole thing. If your skin is brown, then you're down for the old
pain. It's 2013, our chiefs are all shot. Digital blankets give us spiritual smallpox. Certain revelations arise, and my path becomes a cleared reservation. Skies and I could use a little hope sometimes, cause I was dead broke when I wrote this rhyme. So faith in myself's what I'm supposed to find. Play culture, Red Rover, and I broke the line. I blew right past it, rap few like acid. Mind of an activist, my cult a suicide. Who mastered hip-hop to fight his battle. Saddle up this beat and let my rhymes unravel, yeah. Oh God, call your cavalry, because I leave stereotypes as casualties, yeah. Better call your cavalry, because I leave all your doubts as casualties. I don't see no reservations now. I'm trying to get up out of here. I don't need somebody tell me how I'm supposed to live my life in fear. These borders can't hold me back. Can't hold me back. These borders can't hold me back. Can't hold me back.
Up on my clothes now. Look it all around, look around at the whole thing. If your skin is brown, then you're down for the old pain. Look it all around, look around at the whole thing. If your skin is brown, then you're down for the old pain. Look it all around, look around at the whole thing. If your skin is brown, then you're down for the old pain. Look it all around, look around at the whole thing. If your skin is brown, then you're down for the old pain.
That was Leela Gilday with Heart of the People. And before that, Aboriginal by Frank Wallen. And before that, the new A Tribe Called Red song released today. You heard it here, folks. Unless you have SoundCloud, then you've heard it second or third here. The new Tribe Called Red single called Burn Your Village to the Ground. We are now going to play our interview with friend of the show and Native historian Laura Reagan as we discuss Thanksgiving and the myths surrounding that. Just like a turkey dinner, that is a mouthful to say. So we will be speaking with Laura Reagan, and we cover Native food as well, and that is one way you can take back Thanksgiving. If you go on our Facebook page, Rose City Native Radio, we have already posted at least one Native recipe for Three Sisters Stew. And we would love for you to go on our Facebook page and like that status, as well as maybe share some of your traditional recipes that you like to make. This is one way we can decolonize Thanksgiving, cook Native foods, and celebrate our survival. And then everything will be great. So here is our interview with Laura Reagan here on KBOO Portland, Rose City Native Radio. And returning is friend of the show, Laura Reagan. Laura, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks for having me on the show again.
So we're just going to jump right into it. Thanksgiving. So many problems with that.
Yeah, you know, actually, I saw on Facebook yesterday a friend of mine shared a thing that came across her Facebook news feed or whatever it's called now, that, you know, this local school had made this, you know, teepee for their classroom and had somebody decorate it, and the decorations looked like blood smears. And she was just like, other than the fact that this is in poor taste, being, you know, making a teepee for whatever, you know, the decorations on their own, like, that's just distasteful, to say the least, you know. But, like, so many schools do that, and hopefully without the looking like blood smears, but, you know, so many schools do the, you know, let's dress up like pilgrims and Indians, and, you know, trying to teach the kids this, you know, fairy tale about this holiday, you know, and it's pretty absurd, but, you know, a lot of people still to this day, you know, even adults don't know the reality of what really happened in this country.
So let's go back to that day then, the landing of the Mayflower and their first winter there.
Well, so the, you know, the Pilgrims landed and their first winter was, you know, a lot harsher than they were expecting. But, you know, as far as I know, there were some, you know, local natives who took pity on the, you know, poor, starving, freezing people and did help them out. But this whole, you know, fairy tale of this Thanksgiving where they all sat down and had peace and harmony and all of that is just that. It's a fairy tale. And, you know, there was a famous, well, not famous among non-natives, but, you know, massacre that actually occurred. And that's what the actual holiday was originally celebrating, was that this massacre and killing all of these people to make way for the white settlers.
And which tribes were there?
The Pequot and Wampanoag. The leader of the group was later named King Philip by the settlers in the area, although that was not his, you know, given name, but they called him King Philip. And the Pequot and Wampanoag people, a very large group of them, were taken as slaves to the island of Bermuda. And there are actually large native communities who still live in Bermuda today that are descendants from the people who were taken as slaves. I actually, in fact, know a girl who lives in Bermuda and has lived there her whole life, and she is a descendant from the Pequot that were taken as slaves, and her dad was asked to come back to and she came as well to a Pequot powwow in the Northeast, and he carried the Bermuda flag, and it was, you know, the first time that this, you know, flag had been carried and these people had been represented, and there were a lot of, like, elders that were in tears just seeing these people coming back to their powwow, and it was a really big deal for them.
Wow, that's so beautiful. And, you know, the slave trade and all kinds of tensions like that between the natives and the settlers eventually led up to King Philip's War. Is that right?
Yes, that's exactly right. And that at the, you know, the end result of King Philip's War was not only a lot of people being killed, but that those people being taken as slaves to Bermuda.
Either you were sold off into slavery or you would die from, you know, all kinds of illnesses that were brought over as well.
Yes, that is correct. You know, that's one thing that a lot of people don't realize, because initially, you know, the settlers, the European settlers that came here, you know, and the whole idea of manifest destiny and it's, you know, having this continent for the Americans, you know, it was predicated on this myth that this was a, you know, virginal landscape that was relatively devoid of people and it was this untamed wilderness. And that is also a myth. You know, the natives who had lived here had practiced, you know, clearing techniques and farming for, you know, more than a millennia. And so the wilderness was, you know, by and large tamed, if you want to, you know, use the word that they used, as well as the fact that, you know, the older estimates of the amount of people was perhaps a million people in North and South America combined. And you know, historians and anthropologists have since concluded that that is an extreme underestimation, that there were closer to 100 million people in North and South America. And 90% of those people died either from warfare or disease, which was the biggest killer, you know, within the first few years of contact. So the disease especially was the biggest thing because, you know, trade routes were so extensive across North and South America. And, you know, archaeologists have found, you know, tropical feathers in the Northeast. They've found, you know, stones that are, you know, native to a specific area all over the continents, both of them. And so, you know, trade was very extensive and the trade routes were very extensive as well. And so disease, in that way, traveled along the trade routes before Europeans made it into the interior of the continent. And when European settlers arrived in places like where I live now in Indiana, they found villages full of skeletons because the diseases were so bad along the trade routes that everybody in the village would die, and there would be nobody left to clean up the deceased people and to, you know, properly bury them because the disease hit so hard. And so they, you know, so by the time Europeans got here, the diseases were already here, as well as European goods, such as, you know, iron and firearms and, you know, items of that nature as well.
And also, I think we covered this a little bit in the Columbus episode, but another one of the problems is, you know, just a vast difference in how we live our daily lives. You know, natives were actually very cleanly and didn't live within super close contact with animals. They went out and hunted and things like that. But the Europeans, on the other hand, lived in very close contact with their livestock, which gave way to a bunch of wonderful diseases that they brought over that we were just not used to at all.
Yeah, well, the diseases that were pre-existing in North America, I have a list somewhere, but what I can remember off the top of my head are like Lyme disease, Rocky Mountain spotted fever, and it's debated that syphilis, but that's still being debated among anthropologists, and a few other diseases were native to North America. But by and large, diseases like smallpox, influenza, plague, all of those diseases were not diseases that had been seen in the Americas yet. And so, you know, Europeans, you know, diseases like smallpox, influenza were, you know, common nuisance. They were still potentially deadly. However, they were not as severe as, like, kind of like when, you know, when we get chickenpox as a kid and then, you know, you're over it and you're immune for the rest of your life, it's not a big deal. But when you come into contact with somebody who's never had an, it's what is called an acquired immunity to that disease, and especially when you come across a whole population that does not have an acquired immunity to that disease, it gives way to massive pandemics. And so that was why these diseases were so particularly devastating when, you know, Europeans, they were not devastating for them because they had these acquired immunities already where they could still, you know, catch the disease, but it would be a minor nuisance rather than something that would wipe out an entire city. And unfortunately for the native people here, without that acquired immunity, that's exactly what it did.
So the numbers were already starting to thin out by the time the first boat of settlers got here then.
Well, you know, the Spanish were the first to arrive, like we discussed in the Columbus episode. And so they were the first ones to bring diseases over. That was why Cortez was able to conquer Tenochtitlan like he did, was because there was a soldier who was there who had smallpox. And when the Aztecs barricaded themselves within the walls of the city, that allowed smallpox to just completely devastate all the people that were living there. And so these diseases traveled north from the area of Spanish contact. So by the time that English arrived and French arrived in the northeast, yes, the populations were already starting to decline because of the diseases that were brought over by the Spanish.
So back to the story of Plymouth, you know, everyone's told in school that it's this celebration of, you know, peace between the two cultures, the settlers and the Indians. And, you know, now we come to find that that's not actually the case. And horrible things happen, like, you know, Indians being sold into slavery and the end of King Philip's War, which ended up with him being decapitated, his head put on a spike outside of Plymouth and letting it rot there for 25 years. People don't know about this stuff.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, that was something that Europeans had been doing, not to native people, but they their punishment for, you know, for traitors, for example, was to be drawn and quartered and your head left on the spike of whatever town you represented, whether it be York or Kent or whatever, you know. And that was an English punishment already for traitors. And it was supposed to give warning to other people who sympathized with that person. They would see this head sitting there and say, oh gosh, you know, I should be careful. I shouldn't anger the king or whatever, you know. And so that was already something that Europeans did. As barbaric as it is, it was something that Europeans did. So that's why, you know, that was the kind of punishment they decided for him. They decapitated him and set his head on a pike and let it rot to be a, you know, warning to other natives to not try to, do anything against the European settlers, because this could potentially be your fate as well, you know. And particularly, I'm not exactly familiar with Northeastern Native spirituality or religious practices, but I know for my own, you know, having somebody's body not being buried is particularly devastating, because at least in my own culture, it's believed that if this person's body is not buried and buried whole, then your spirit does not go to the afterlife. And so I imagine there's likely some similarities with the Northeastern spiritual practices as well, that is a particularly devastating thing.
And also, I think we covered this before, but, you know, when these settlers arrived, you know, a lot of the time they would settle in these abandoned native villages and basically kind of grave rob just to survive and live there and then establish these huge villages there. I think that's how Plymouth got started as well.
Yeah, a lot of the Northeastern, you know, establishments, you know, were initially, and even, you know, the ones that were, you know, not taking from Native villages were in very close proximity to Native establishments. It's really interesting if you look at really early maps of the Northeast and the way that they would depict settlements. They would depict European settlements by drawing a little house on the map and say the name of the settlement, and they would depict Native settlements, which were often just, you know, across the river or the bay or whatever, by drawing a little tree, which I think is very telling that they believed that the Native people that they were encountering were somehow less than them, because, you know, Europeans got a little house on the map, which is, you know, a sign of civilization and, you know, modernity, whereas the Natives were depicted by a tree showing that they're, you know, closer to nature or, you know, whatever. But, yeah, so they often would come into villages and, you know, abandoned villages or just areas that were, you know, a lot of Native tribes had seasonal lands where, you know, they would spend the spring and into harvest season in this particular area, and then they would winter in another area. So a lot of times they would come across establishments that were maybe used for seasonal use, go ahead and settle there because the land was already cleared, the trees were already cut, and it was, you know, already habitable and able to be built upon already, than having to go in and clear the forest themselves, because the Natives had done that for them probably generations earlier. And like you said about, you know, just the cleanliness, I realized I didn't actually say anything about that. That's one of the early, like the early depictions of Native peoples of their opinions about Europeans was how bad they smelled.
Yeah, spoiled milk, I think was the term, or something like that.
Yeah, that they smelled very bad, and that they, one, you have to think about the fact that they'd spent, you know, however many months on a boat. I can't imagine anybody without, you know, proper hygiene on a boat for 6 months would smell good. Even, you know, after they were off the boat and, you know, had built their settlements and all of that, you know, European hygiene practices just weren't as good as Native hygiene practices. And they didn't bathe very often because they believed that it was not healthy. They often didn't drink water, but would drink ale or beer or wine rather than water, because in Europe, you know, your sewer was your street, which ran to your river. You couldn't drink the water out of the river in a big city like London or Paris. It was just not safe. So the Natives, on the other hand, would bathe and drank water and knew not to poop where you eat. And so that was something very shocking for the Natives to see, is these people who just, in their minds, lived more like animals because they didn't understand hygiene practices that the Natives already understood. It's very telling of European culture as to why this is the case, because during the, you know, the Greek and the Roman and the Moorish empires, they understood basic hygiene and sanitization. And then when what became the medieval period or the Dark Ages came around in Europe, they believed that all of this knowledge that the Muslim empire had and the Greek empire and the Roman empire had was heretical knowledge, because it was not Christian, and they banned all of these practices and teachings, which included hygiene. And so there was this period of several hundred years where Europeans kind of forgot not to poop where you eat.
So you had mentioned at the beginning how Thanksgiving also was a day to celebrate the slaughter of Indians.
Well, it was just a it was a day of Thanksgiving because the Europeans had seen it that they had won this battle with Indian people, and that it was a sign from God that they were supposed to have this land. And so it was a day of Thanksgiving to give thanks to their God, to thank him for giving them the land by allowing them to win against the Indians.
Basically like Manifest Destiny Day.
Basically, yes. And you know, the story of Squanto and him helping them and all of that, you know, as far as I know, like my area of expertise is actually the Southwest, but I have done some research in that area. So as far as I know, he was a real person. He spoke English because he had encountered other Europeans prior to the Pilgrims. And so he spoke English and was able to, you know, help them out, help them with, you know, the fact that they couldn't figure out how to grow anything or, you know, farm in the way that they were used to and all of that. But the real Thanksgiving was not for his help or for natives, you know, and them coming together, but it was in fact for their celebration of their manifest destiny in North America.
So when did the romanticized version of Thanksgiving start?
I believe it started in the 19th century. A lot of myths about native people, you know, the myth of the Indian princess, the myth of, you know, various native myths of, they're not native myths, but myths of native people became around the centennial of the United States, but also, you know, earlier in that, in the 19th century, and during the whole time of the idea of manifest destiny and moving westward and, you know, having the whole continent be part of the United States and all of that, was when these myths of, you know, these friendly native folks stepping aside started to emerge within American folklore. And so the, you know, the holiday in itself didn't really come about until then. I mean, there was typically, you know, a lot of cultures, including Europeans and various native cultures, would often celebrate during the harvest time with a feast because, you know, it was celebrating the bountiful harvest. But the actual, you know, Thanksgiving holiday didn't come about until much later.
I want to cover food as well, because that's also a big part of Thanksgiving. You know, one way I think you can take back Thanksgiving in a way is like celebrating by cooking a lot of native foods. And there's a lot out there that people don't really seem to realize.
A lot of the food that a lot of people associate, people associate tomatoes with Italian food, you know, that's not till after the 16th century because tomatoes are indigenous to the Americas. Potatoes, everyone always associates potatoes with Ireland, but potatoes are indigenous to Peru. The turkey is called the turkey because they didn't realize that they were indigenous to North America and thought they must be indigenous to Asia, so they called them the turkey. You know, so a lot of foods that a lot of people, I mean, I think turkeys are still associated with America, but a lot of foods that people associate with different cultures in Europe, you know, were not, those associations didn't happen until, you know, post-16th century when those foods were brought there. And for years, Europeans thought that, you know, tomatoes were poisonous.
Yeah, well, as far as I'm concerned, tomatoes are poisonous, but that's for a whole other reason. So on Thanksgiving, does your family do any traditional cooking at all?
Well, my family always has fry bread.
Of course.
Yeah, I mean, of course. I was really upset last year because my dad, he's going through a divorce right now, but he, for the last 6 years, had been married to a white woman. And last year, she wouldn't let me make fry bread. And she always wanted to do the big white Thanksgiving with turkey and potatoes and, you know, like that kind of Thanksgiving. And I was like, okay, well, you know, when my sister Kelly and I get there, we'll make the fry bread. And she was like, no, we're not making fry bread this year. I'm just like, this is not okay. But I was talking to my dad recently, and I was just like, oh, I know we don't really do anything for Thanksgiving, but we haven't had a good Apache meal in a long time. Why don't we, you know, get together this November and have fry bread and mole and, you know, black beans and corn and yellow rice and some corn soup or pozole and, like, all of those foods that we love that are, you know, traditional And a lot of people, when I say, oh, good Apache food like pozole, they're like, isn't it a Mexican food? And I, well, it was Apache food first. Then it became a Mexican food. Which I imagine was probably similar for your traditional foods as well.
Yeah, yeah, because we're like right on the border, so we have a lot of things like that too. It's like, isn't that Mexican? No, no, we make blue corn tortillas.
Yeah, that's another one. Tortillas are another, like the blue corn tortillas, that's another one that we made first.
Yeah, and I'm looking forward to learning how to do that soon. I'm all about the blue corn right now. Can't get enough of it.
My sister and her husband make their own tortillas. They're pretty tasty.
Yeah, that's the only way to do it, man. Make your own, because it tastes way better than the store-bought.
Oh, yeah. They're delicious. I make this really good corn soup with bison in it and hummy, and it's one thing that my family can never get enough of. Not even just my family. My friends can't get enough of it. My friend was sick about a month ago and begged me to make her corn soup and fry bread. So I was like, all right, and I made the corn soup and fry bread for her. She's like, I love you. You're the best friend ever, you know.
Yeah.
And the last time I made pozole, my boyfriend ate, like, pretty much the entire pot of soup. He loved it. But that's one thing I've always loved is when we do have a good Apache dinner with, you know, some fry bread or tortillas and tamales and all of those foods that I love. I had a really sad moment because, you know, a lot of people associate tamales with, like, Christmas.
Yeah.
So I said something to my dad, and I was like, oh, man, Dad, I would love some tamales. I haven't had that in so long. Could you make those? You know, it's about that time of year. And he was like, I don't know how to make tamales. And I was like, yeah, you do. You always made them when I was a kid. He's like, oh, no, those were store-bought.
Oh, no.
And I was just like, childhood ruined.
Oh, gee. All the lies all these years.
Yeah.
And that's a good way for, Indians and anyone else interested to kind of reclaim the holiday. Cook native foods for your Thanksgiving feast instead. And, instead of thinking of it as a settler native alliance day, more of a day of remembrance for the native tribes, a more of a Native American day of remembrance where we all get together and are thankful for our family and thankful for the fact that we are still here. Still thriving in our culture, aware of life still exists, our foods still exist, and you should try them. If you've had popcorn, you've had native food. If you've had tortillas or, you know, so many native foods.
Good Northeastern food. If you want to remember the people who, you know, were the victims of the pilgrims around the time of the first Thanksgiving, a good Northeastern food, and I bet if you Google it, you can find it. It's called Three Sisters Stew. And it's something I had at our local Native community center. We had like a get together, and somebody brought this Three Sisters stew, and the three sisters are corn, beans, and squash. And so look up the recipe for that and make that and add that to your table for Thanksgiving. And, you know, do that to remember the Native people who suffered at the hands of the pilgrims.
I have heard of Three Sisters stew, and I have heard it is heaven.
Oh, it's delicious. It's absolutely delicious.
Oh, man. I'm so hungry right now.
Me too. It's a lot later here, so it's about dinner time.
Oh, geez, yeah. Okay, so we're going to go ahead and wrap it up then. Laura, I want to thank you so much for joining us today and talking with us. It's always a pleasure having you on the show.
Yeah, I'm so glad to be here, and I'm looking forward to doing it again.
Nega nikuha suma. Nega digigero to nechina to wile. Ne anti dohwe nuni. Ne yuwa nikura, tanakan hura to slana, and to what kawechina de toat lenu. Tanga diwa eoni noon at toa kela de nechinunia hunchatatu. Ne waila wero, yuwa nishtaka hake. Ne yuki hawi, diokishna. Oni aguego suma na hota de sungawi. Chinunya hunchatatu, aguegona ne, dietino horunyo. Oni nanagaili nyo kuala le, chinun tadia taqua, radiwa rasta, juata hunchad. Oni chikara kualunyo. Oni jijisto kualunyo. Negati aguego, chinichilo guatago, kanuala dun santoa. tankati vai yli hokue ku en jo te tuo tahso sinne oli te tuo si take en jo lia di tuo ni hahlu näin suko ja tisu negati vai kun tuo vatko ei kanhora tuotsi kun jo en jo tuo take eikä di ni otta ei vaki huu. Say thank you to the earth for everything that she gives to us, nourishing us every day. We give thanks to all the water in the world, everything within that water. We give thanks to all the grass that lives on the land. We give thanks to all the berries, the fruits, the medicines. We give thanks to the animals that keep the forest clean. We give thanks to all the trees for the different uses that they give to us. Our shelters, the fires that we make in the wintertime, keeping us warm. We give thanks to the birds who sing their beautiful songs. We give thanks to the four winds. We give thanks to the grandfathers, the ones that brings the rain. And we give thanks to our oldest brother, the sun, who shines his light every day. We give thanks to our oldest grandmother, the moon, for she is the one that has been charged with the duty to make sure that life has a continuance. She is the one that watches over all the movements of the water, and also the water within us. We give thanks to the stars, her helper. And we give a special thanksgiving to the four sacred beings that watch over the human family. Sometimes we notice them when we are traveling in dangerous places. They are the ones that come to our minds and say, go around, don't go any further. And so that's what we're there for. Protect us, steer us away from danger. And so that's what we do. We start right from the earth and we climb a ladder right to the special place beyond the heavens where there's a special spirit that lives there. The spirit that made it possible for us to be here and everything that we have mentioned. And so with the collectedness of our minds and hearts, we send a special thanksgiving and greeting to the great spirit of us all.
I want to thank everybody for listening in today. The song you just heard was Giving Thanks by Joanne Shenandoah, featuring Chief Jake Swamp of the Mohawk Nation. Let's take Thanksgiving back, Indian country. One stew, one tortilla, one bit of food at a time to remind people where we come from. Let's use this as a time to celebrate resistance and survival. We are still here. Our culture is still here. We are not going anywhere. We have survived plagues, invasion, assimilation. All attempts have failed. Let's use this holiday to celebrate our ancestors and those who fought to keep our culture alive. Cook native food on Thanksgiving. Cook your traditional food. Share it with others. Share your stories with others. Again, thank you so much for listening. You can find us on Facebook at Rose City Native Radio for behind-the-scenes photos of what goes on in this studio. You can find us on Instagram at Rose City Native Radio. If you have any questions or comments or things you would like us to cover, you can email us at pdxnativeradio@gmail.com. If you're interested in volunteering here at KBOO, you can email volunteer@kboo.org. And again, thank you so much for listening, Indian Country, and everyone else across Turtle Island. I wish you a happy holiday. Remember the ancestors. Remember those who fought to keep us here. We are still here. We're not going anywhere. I will see you next week. Have a good night. The time is 7 p.m. Coming up next, Hard Knock Radio on KBOO Portland.
Be a part of Giving Tuesday on December 2nd, a day that inspires personal philanthropy and encourages bigger, better, and smarter charitable giving during the holiday season. KBOO is excited to participate, and we have a $5,000 match for the month of December. All new memberships and additional donations made by current members will be matched. If you gave $60 last year and decide to give $100, it will be matched for the $40 increase. If you give monthly and give an additional one-time gift, that amount will be matched. Go to kboo.fm/give to make your donation now. And thank you to the Juan Young Trust, Vernier Software, SSI Shredding Systems, and the Wendy Foundation for empowering KBOO with their matching contributions. Thank you for your support.
KBOO at the Clinton, a monthly film screening at the Clinton Street Theater, is proud to show 5 broken